Hello, and welcome back to Climate Changes Everything. This is episode 14, Take Me to the River, part 2. In our last episode, we plunged into the world of dams and one of their main uses, the generation of electricity. Water, gravity, concrete, steel, what's so complicated about that? And how could that be anything but good? Well, regular listeners of this podcast know that with everything in energy, seeming simplicity hides a lot of necessary complexity, a lot of compromises. Some probably counterintuitive. Remember that tipping point where natural gas is worse for the climate than coal? Those familiar cartoon cowboys of white hats, black hats, and gray hats rode away screaming many episodes ago. The good, bad, and the ugly, all blending into one big, complex, and vitally important gray mess. It's the same for dams and hydroelectric power, of course. For much of recorded history, humans have tried to both make the power of falling water work for them, while at the same time keeping the power of falling water from destroying what they hold dear. More broadly, for all of history, and not just the tiny fraction that's recorded, access to and control of water has been the key to life on Earth, whether you're bipedal or four-legged. From the most insignificant waterhole or creek to the biggest lakes and the grandest rivers, access and control. And so it is for dams. The essence of a dam is water access and control. That sounds as much like economics and politics as it does engineering and concrete. So let's dive in. The water's fine. As we talked about in the last episode, dams can serve many purposes, often many purposes for the same dam. Creating positive outcomes like electricity generation, crop irrigation, and the ability to travel by boat, and avoiding negative outcomes like floods and thirst. The Swiss Army knives of the infrastructure world. All of those outcomes drive human welfare and economic development in different ways. Permanent human settlements, require flood control and irrigation, with navigation, water storage, and electricity generation serving as a multiplier. Modern Los Angeles is a great example of this, with local dams controlling floods and providing irrigation for agriculture, and hundreds of miles away on the Colorado River, bigger, more distant dams like Hoover providing both water and electricity. But that's where the politics comes in, access and control. Water rights in the western United States come to a head on the Colorado River. Climate change is reducing the river's natural flow at the same time that population growth in California, Las Vegas, and elsewhere in the West demands ever more water. And it's not just contentious between the U.S. states. The Colorado River empties into the sea in Mexico, or it once did. Now, pretty much all the water is siphoned off upstream in the U.S., leaving the Mexican reaches dry, along with a once-thriving natural and human ecosystem. And no way to travel by boat, of course. We see the same struggle for access and control about 8,000 miles to the east on the Great River Nile. While most think of the Nile as an Egyptian river, it actually touches no less than 11 countries over its 4,000 miles. The Democratic Republic of Congo, Tanzania, Burundi, Rwanda, Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Eritrea, South Sudan, the Republic of Sudan, and that's all before reaching Egypt and then the Mediterranean. As you can imagine, the politics of the Nile, who has access to and control of its waters, is mind-bogglingly complex and fundamentally important to the societies and economies it passes through. In a region with very little rainfall, river water is life. An astounding 97% of all Egypt's water, says one source. Water is life, and in a region with very long memories, water has thus always meant conflict. Back in 1970, the completion of Egypt's massive Aswan Dam changed everything. Aswan, located near Egypt's southern border with Sudan, meant water security for the Egyptians. And recall here that the Nile flows south to north, so the Nile enters Egypt from Sudan and flows northwards towards the Med. When extraordinary famine gripped the region in the 1980s, most famously in Ethiopia, Egypt was sustained by the water impounded by Aswan, as well as the more than 2 gigawatts of electricity it produced as the water moved south to north. We'll get into gigawatts, megawatts, kilowatts soon enough, but suffice it to say, 2 gigawatts is a massive power plant. Water security and energy security in a region chronically short on both. 75 years ago, Aswan was ground zero for a seemingly zero-sum game of local and geopolitics, desperate Cold War rivalry, and thus the courting of non-aligned nations like Egypt between the U.S. and the USSR, and regional economic development and influence. Today, competing schemes upstream of Egypt threaten to choke the supply to downstream Aswan, and thus Egypt itself. For example, Ethiopia's magnificently named and equally ambitious Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is, in turn, a focal point for the Nile River conflict today. But remember, Egypt and Ethiopia are only 2 of the 11 countries that share the Nile. Access and control for water and energy security, a recipe for prosperity and for conflict, and a recipe for environmental impact across landscapes, habitats, and species. Landscape impacts are probably the most obvious, or at least the most visible. Dam construction is not just a process of filling in a gap between 2 cliffs or 2 hills. Dam construction is not just a process of submerging a place in its natural state, ready to be restored by eventually draining the water away. The requisite blasting, tunneling, road building, dams fundamentally alter the natural landscape. Dams can be drained, dams can be removed, but the landscapes are permanently changed. I'll give you a personal example. I was lucky enough to take a boat trip down China's Yangtze River in 1988. 3 days by boat from Chongqing in the far west to the city of Nanjing, where I was a student at the time. I will never forget the morning we passed through the Three Gorges, one of the natural wonders of China and the world. Even if I hadn't known what it was, I would never have forgotten it. Simultaneously colossal and hauntingly beautiful, the landscape equivalent of Gustav Mahler's First Symphony, that's the closest analog I can come up with. Blasted away with untold millions of tons of explosives, over 100 million cubic meters of soil moved, and drowned in a reservoir so large that the weight of the water in it, concentrated in that one spot, actually has a measurable effect on the Earth's rotation. Never to be seen or to inspire again. The Three Gorges is now home to one of the world's, or in fact the world's largest hydroelectric dam by generating capacity, 22.5 gigawatts spread across 34 Francis-style hydroelectric turbines. By way of comparison, that's almost half of California's record peak power demand in a single facility. And California's economy itself is the 4th largest in the world, neck and neck with Germany and closing in on India. A giant plant and a giant picture window into the compromises of hydroelectric power. Eyes wide, wide, wide open. Let's bring on the necessary complexity. Let's start with the basics. Take a big river like the Yangtze, flowing about 1 million cubic feet per second and the lifeblood of a broad, diverse, and winding 4,000-mile natural and human ecosystem. Now block it so that you can facilitate one of its functions, controlling the weight of moving water in preference to all of its other functions. In other words, what happens when you take a complex, dynamic natural system and solve for only one of its components, leaving that one component dynamic, some of the water, and suddenly making all the others static? That's correct. All those other components suddenly hitting a wall, both literally and figuratively, with consequences across all the other components in that complex, dynamic natural system. Now, hydroelectric production is a very good thing from a climate perspective. 22.5 gigawatts represents a huge amount of coal that doesn't need to be burned every year. No burning fossil fuels, just running water. Beautiful, carbon-free energy. Again, in terms of the electricity production itself. But, and it turns out to be a really big but, consider the submerged landscape and all the sediments that build up behind the dam as the flowing river runs into it. Animal and plant matter submerged, or hitting that wall and piling up, and then rotting. Burping methane into the atmosphere over a dam's decades and often centuries of existence. With a broader lens and better measurement techniques, studies are beginning to show that these non-power generation emissions can create significant compromises for ostensibly carbon-free energy. Every dam is unique in its own set of circumstances, of course, its type, its scale, its location, but a few very important conclusions are beginning to emerge. First, run-of-river, aka diversion, dams tend to have a lower GHG footprint than reservoir types. That makes intuitive sense. No drowned forests or jungles to decompose. No wall where material coming down the river can hit it and stop and rot. Second, location, location, location. Reservoir dams in temperate regions with less vegetation and cooler ambient temperatures seem to be about as GHG friendly as other renewable energy sources. Reservoirs in tropical regions, though, with more vegetation and hotter ambient temperatures, oh my goodness, up to 27 times the footprint of other renewables. And that's here's the really scary part, around 6 times the GHG footprint of fossil fuel electricity. That's an extraordinary result, especially as much of the world's untapped hydroelectric power is in tropical regions. Yikes. So too from an environmental perspective. Now, every dam has its own environmental story. Flora and fauna vary around the world, after all. But the Three Gorges paints a fairly typical picture. Prior to the dam, the area had been quite biodiverse, both for aquatic and terrestrial species, both flora and fauna, and a lot of tree cover, which provided both habitat and mitigation of floods, erosion, and landslides. Now, block the river with 28 million cubic meters of concrete, think about the Hoover Dam and then multiply by 8, and almost 500,000 tons of steel, having moved over 100 cubic meters of earth. Dams tend to change everything, especially for the river itself. Aquatic species facing fatal changes in water temperature, dissolved oxygen levels, and altered biology and chemistry, both in the reservoir and in the 600 or so miles from the dam to the ocean. Not to mention spinning turbine blades, increased ship traffic, and blocked spawning routes. At least 2 major extinctions, the Chinese river dolphin and the Chinese paddlefish, have already resulted from the dam. How about flood control, the other big objective of Three Gorges? Chinese history is a litany of flood and devastation along the lower reaches of the Yangtze. In fact, civil engineering in general, and water control in particular, play a major part in China's 3+ millennia of recorded history. Just in the most recent parts of those last 3+ millennia, the flood years are a part of China's collective and very long memory. 1870, 1931, 1954, 1998. Everybody knows these dates. Lost harvests, drinking water, starvation, disease, many dying long after the floodwater itself had receded. 3.7 million people dead in the 1931 flood alone, probably the world's worst natural disaster of the 20th century. Fast forward to 2010, with the dam in place, and another potentially catastrophic flood. The Three Gorges Dam, with a reservoir big enough to impact the Earth's rotation, was almost enough to maintain normal flows downstream. Almost. Some of the water had to be let through to keep the dam from overflowing. But orders of magnitude less death and destruction. Hundreds in 2010 versus millions pre-dam. Some of the water still had to be let through, resulting in significant damage and hundreds of lives lost downstream. That said, periodic flooding avoided downstream has to be balanced against permanent flooding upstream. A reported 1.24 million people displaced, submerging 13 cities, 140 towns, and over 1,000 villages, along with cultural and archaeological treasures, not to mention the social, economic, and psychological stresses of relocation. So, those compromises. Between 22 gigawatts of electricity and a 3-millennia dream of flood mitigation, you can imagine the attraction of a dam at Three Gorges and how the inherent compromises might, through that lens, be seen as acceptable. But man, that's a lot of caveats. And to imagine we started with a simple equation of river plus elevation change equals power. A lot of necessary complexity and more to come. So with that, how does climate change everything when it comes to dams in general and hydroelectric power in particular? And where are the opportunities for innovation, entrepreneurship, and advocacy? I'll see you soon for the next episode of Climate Changes Everything. In the meantime, I want to give a big shout out to everyone tuning in from my hometown of Evanston, Illinois, Matt, Lisa, and Tim in particular. Thanks for listening. Thank you.